This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, September 23rd, 2012. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. The 5th annual Swing for the Cure Golf Classic will be held Saturday, October 6th at Shallow Valley Country Club in Rogers. This 18-hole scramble tournament includes breakfast, lunch, prizes, and more. Proceeds to benefit Susan G. Komen Ozark. More information is available at komenozark.org or by calling 750-PINK.
Ahead on this weekend edition of Ozarks, National Coffee Day celebrated with a visit to a local roaster and distributor and a closer look at environmental infrastructure and recycling news in this morning's Week in Review.
But first, this year marks the 40th anniversary of the Buffalo becoming the first national river, the 50th anniversary of the Ozark Society, and the 100th anniversary of the birth of Dr. Neil Compton. To celebrate, I took a field trip to the former home of Dr. Compton, which is located in Bentonville. Today, it is the home of Compton Gardens and Conference Center, a public event and education center. I began my report with a quote from the man credited with saving the buffalo.
My first experience on the buffalo came about through a Methodist preacher in our hometown named Stan Hayden. And he was raised over in that country, and he wanted to go on a float. And back in those days, they didn't do it like they do now. He went over there and bought a John boat, a new one, which was heavy as lead, for $5. And we floated the river for 3 days and left it. We didn't bother about trying to take it home with us. And when we got down to the far end, we were sunburned, and we were tired, and we were sore. And I wasn't inspired to go back and do that again, just to tell you the truth.
That's Dr. Neil Compton, speaking about the river he loved and fought for. That was recorded for Ozarks at Large in 1992. Dr. Compton has since passed, but his legacy lives on through the Compton Gardens and Conference Center in Bentonville. Though the center opened a few years ago, it was just last month that an exhibit honoring the late Dr. Compton was unveiled. Connie Hendricks-Krall, executive director of the Peel Compton Foundation, speaks of the home built in the early 1950s.
And I will tell you this, the first day I was on the job, I was taken over here, and I looked at it and I said, oh, this must be a Faye Jones. And I'll tell you why I think anybody that understands his architecture is the fact that it didn't have a garage. It was a carport, and where the Neil Compton exhibit room was the actual carport. And so consequently, you'd see his Jeep out there with his canoe, which we have one of the last two canoes in there.
On this particular afternoon, the building is being used for a conference. It can be rented out for events of any type. The only room that we are able to access is the exhibit room. A collaboration among the Compton Foundation, Ozark Society Foundation, Walmart Visitor Center, and the University of Arkansas Special Collections, the exhibit lines the walls of what once was that carport, mostly pictures, letters, and awards. There is also the canoe that Connie spoke of. Much different from the fiberglass canoes floaters use these days, Dr. Compton's is aluminum, long, and heavy. The triangle design that lines the rim also lines the walls of the exhibit room. A lover of the outdoors since childhood, Dr. Compton finally fell for the buffalo upon returning from World War II.
Well, I became more acquainted with it then because arriving back from the conflict we'd all been in, a desire to see the scenery here in the Ozarks and realizing that it is magnificent, much better than we'd all been led to believe who grew up here. And the Buffalo Country was probably the most stunning. My first trip through Boxley Valley and then familiarizing ourselves with the buffalo. We didn't do a lot of floating on it then because we didn't know how, but we would learn. Good canoes weren't available till about 1952, the good Grumman aluminum canoe and all that. And then we had to get with some people who knew how to do it, and when we did, it was a great reward to see the beautiful waters of the Buffalo.
Dr. Compton is often credited with saving the Buffalo River when it was threatened with being dammed in the 1960s. He founded the Ozark Society, the organization that led the fight, writing letters to Senator Fulbright, bringing Supreme Court justices to visit the river.
Yeah, we had the Honorable John Paul Hammersmith, who was a relative newcomer to the House of Representatives, and he came around sort of at the end and helped with the final push It's interesting that when he ran in 1966, he defeated Jim Trimble, who was a pro Dam the Buffalo. He didn't run on that issue, but it's ironic how it all turned out.
One can only imagine what Arkansas would be like without the Buffalo National River. The 95,000 acres and 180 miles of river that Dr. Compton took part in saving have been the location for many beautiful memories. Not just a conservationist, Compton was also a naturalist. The center sits on 6.5 acres of lush natural gardens, maintained by a staff of 5.
Well, it's native Ozark habitat. So consequently, when we've had these two bad summers, we still had to do some watering, but not nearly to the level because they're native. We lost nothing last summer. But it's planted in very much of a naturalistic setting. We have a trail system that goes all the way through it. It's a wonderful trail system. And then we have signage that identifies the various plants that are here.
This land backs up to Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, the Compton Gardens Trail even serving as a pedestrian entrance to the museum. What a lot of people don't know is that the land that Crystal Bridges sits was once owned by Dr. Compton. Many of the plants on their trail tours actually planted by Compton.
Yes, he loved azaleas. And actually, if you go over to Crystal Bridges, there's a lot of the same original azaleas still there. And if you look at really old pictures of when the Comptons lived here, he did have azaleas.
Practicing medicine in Bentonville for many years, Dr. Compton was actually the Waltons family doctor, eventually selling them the acreage. Not only that, he also served as nature guide for the Walton children, in particular, Jim Walton.
If you look, I mean, of course, this is radio, so I know nobody can see, but I'm hoping people are curious enough. We have a picture of all of them. Neil Compton took the shot, and at the top of that rock is a very young Jim Walton, who was very close to Dr. Compton. And I know that the whole family really treasures being out in the wild.
In the center of the room is a case containing Compton's coffee cup, a hat, and a favorite plaid shirt he can be seen wearing in some of the photos that line the walls. Connie Hendricks Crawl, too, has a favorite.
I love this last panel, the Buffalo River today, and you can see the map of it, the tributaries, the riverbeds. But the thing that I love the most about it is, number one, this was kind of what we used on our own invitation, was Neil Compton saved a river for the nation. And thanks to Dr. Neil Compton's tireless efforts, the Buffalo River is still available today for everyone to enjoy. One of the most beautiful natural features of not just Arkansas, but the entire United States, the Buffalo represent what's possible when people with passion come together for the right cause.
For more information, visit peelmansion.org/Compton.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, September 23rd, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Dan Kraft. He is Special Projects Reporter for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Morning.
If you listen very closely, you can hear the beginning of the rumble.
You can. And it will get louder and louder for several days.
Talking about bikes, blues, and barbecue.
That's right.
And there's something in the paper today about bikes, blues, and money.
Mostly just the money.
Just the money, okay.
Kevin Kinder from our features department put together sort of a look at the money that goes into and out of Bikes Blues. As you know, they bill themselves as the biggest rally benefiting charities
right.
In the country. So Kevin decided to take a look at, you know, what it costs to put the rally on, where that money goes, and what they donate to the community, both in terms of the checks they hand out most years to charity and the other money they spend that goes into things like electrical upgrades out of the Randall Tyson Track Center.
Right. I always see those little, what do you call them? The four-wheelers, the gators?
Yeah.
I see a lot of volunteers.
Mules
or gators or whatever. I see a lot of those setting stuff up, you know, tomorrow and Tuesday.
Sure. And some of those are your Bikes Blues event organizers, and some of them are people like the Kiwanis Club or the Fayetteville Band Boosters. They'll get out at 6 in the morning and basically clean up whatever's left from the night before. And they get paid, and that's considered a charitable donation for their efforts.
Oh, I see.
So they don't get paid cash, or they do get paid cash?
They do get paid in cash, but it's not handed out with some of the other checks that they typically mm-hmm. give out if they've done well enough at the end of a year.
I see.
Things they give to, like, the Boys and Girls Club and Meals on Wheels, things like that.
So did Kevin Kinder come up with a firm figure of what it costs to put it on?
It varies a lot by year. And what they bring in can vary a lot depending on things as simple as the weather.
Oh.
A rainy Saturday night drops their beer sales really bad, and that's one of their the rally itself's biggest revenue generators.
I see.
They also get money from registration for vendors. And
right, and some of what they include in their charitable donations is the free vendor space they give away to local nonprofits so that they can raise awareness for their own causes during the rally.
Now, And I guess then the amount of checks to charities has varied in the past, because some years it hasn't been quite as much as some people had hoped.
There were a couple of years where they didn't give out any money.
That would be less than people hoped.
Yes.
Yes.
Just a bit. I know back in, I believe it was 2003, they lost a lot of money on a headliner concert. And so they quit doing those for a couple of years, decided on the smaller local acts. And they have brought back bigger concerts a couple of times, but they've worked with promoters so that they're not on the hook for the entire monetary amount of that.
Yeah, when this early, I mean, there would be people like ZZ Top or something like that.
B.B. King, the Allman Brothers.
Right, and that's a hefty price tag.
I think B.B. King is the early one they lost a lot of money on.
So it starts Wednesday?
It does, and you'll hear the rumbles, like I said, probably if you're not hearing them outside your window now, you might start sometime this afternoon.
Okay.
You have a motorcycle, Dan?
No, but if anyone would like to lend me one, that'd be awesome.
Christina, you ride?
No.
Okay.
I had a scooter once.
That's close enough. I've got a Schwinn. So
I wrecked a dirt bike. It hurt.
Yeah. There you go. I hope you had a helmet.
No.
Dan, you should. All right. The Kevin Kinder story about finances and Bikes Blues in today's paper.
That's right.
Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Dan Kraft, Special Projects Reporter. Thanks for your time.
Anytime, guys.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
There are plenty of organizations in the community that help the community. Most of them are nonprofits, and it's sometimes easy to forget that they need help to help others. Last week, Seven Hills Homeless Shelter reached out on their Facebook page to ask for donations of items, food, clothes, and toiletries. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Michael Drager, Brand Relations Director for Seven Hills. Antoinette began by asking him how he knows it's time to ask for help.
Well, as far as an inventory tracking method, no. Our director of our day center, Cynthia, has been doing it for so long that she just has a feel for what's going on. And so she's very resourceful in knowing what to get and how to get it and look at stuff and go, yeah, this is what's going on. So that's pretty much how we gauge it. But then she's just really good at her job. So it's her, I guess, gut feeling where she just kind of knows what's happening. Of course, you can't control who comes in.
Right.
You don't have, you know, the day we had a record number of 160 people come in one day. Well, that's a lot of people to take care of. And so that probably wiped out a lot of our surplus. And so that's why the immediate response of, hey, we need some stuff quickly.
It does seem like it would be hard to plan for something like that when you don't know how many guests you're going to have.
Right, right. Yeah, when you don't know, I mean, we kind of have a record of being able to know what we did last year at this time, so mm-hmm. we kind of know an average, but it is hard to figure out what's going on. You might have a whole new set of people coming in that have never been to the center that needed help, that either got laid off or mm-hmm. evicted or whatever, that might need help. So, yeah, sometimes it's hard to judge and keep track of that, but we do our best.
Any particular reason why you think you had that record day?
No.
It just happens.
Yeah, it just happens. You know, I think on average we see about 110 people a day. So the extra 50 for that day is mm-hmm. Who knows. But typically The last day of the month on Friday, the last Friday of the month, is our busiest usually, because that's when bus passes are handed out. That's when those kinds of things happen. So obviously more people come in for services that may not be homeless, mm-hmm. but need transportation, so they know they can get bus passes, that, which we work with ORT on that. Mm-hmm. So that obviously is a record day for us. Not record day, but that's a higher volume day. Plus we also serve, that's our Friday. Mm-hmm. Every Friday we serve the meal at Seven Hills. Other days we work in the community with the Episcopal Church, First Baptist, and First United Methodist to do the meals, community meals program. So we're in a cooperative on that. Mm-hmm. So Fridays for us are always busier, and especially the last Friday of the month.
Okay. So what are some of the things that you guys need?
We always, always, always need socks. Mm-hmm. That's always a need. You can imagine living in an environment that's not clean.
Sure.
Obviously your socks are always dirty.
Absolutely.
We always need tents, tarps. Those things are high priority as far as just major items, those things. But then convenience food is always something we need. And if you think about it, most people that live in the situations that they are in, they don't have refrigerators, can openers, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So pop-top convenience food is typically what we hand out mostly. Not the healthiest thing in the world, but if you have the choice of not eating or eating, then that's what you go with. So that's always staple needs that we have. Obviously, it changes with season.
Right.
With this cold season coming up, sweatshirts, coats, jackets, those things are always needed. And then just general help of monetary Walmart gift cards that we supplement for people. One of the newest thing we started with our GED classes. And so we have a van of people that for the first time have taken the opportunity to get their GED.
Okay.
Well, they need food during the day because it's a full day class.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so those are extra things that have come our way that we didn't have before.
Right.
And so when you're trying to change the lifestyle of people that are in these situations, that requires more work and more stuff. And so sometimes that might require more needs or more food. Those situations.
I know people tend to think of giving during the holiday season, which is coming up. So do you guys find that you do tend to be lower with supplies the rest of the year?
Typically, people are more giving during the holiday season. That's normal. That's the American culture we live in. But from January through the summer, it gets pretty lean, especially in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
People take off, vacations,
right.
and they're done. So their minds are elsewhere because their life is busy as well. So a lot of times the donations we get from now till December hold us through those tight months in the spring and summer. But yeah, everybody's more aware of the issue around the holidays. And it's funny because people, they think in terms of, well, it's cold outside. What do the homeless people do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do? Mm-hmm. You're cold. You're hot in the summer. And then it doesn't change because they're homeless. They're hot and they're cold. And if it's rainy, it's rainy. And so sometimes that's just a start for us, is educating people and understanding that our philosophy as an organization is that we're trying to end the cycle of homelessness. So sometimes it begins with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or begins with a simple food item. But our goal is always to meet them where they're at and take them further down the road should they choose to do so. And so sometimes that's a lot more work involved. But it always starts with food or meeting a basic need, which is that's just humanity and dignity.
Michael Drager is the Brand Relations Director at Seven Hills Homeless Center in Fayetteville, and I spoke to him yesterday. If you want to make donations, you can go make those at the Day Center, which is located at 1555 West Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Fayetteville. It's just behind Sud's Car Wash. And for an updated list, you can go to facebook.com/7, that's the number 7, Hills Center.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda filed that report for a daily edition of Ozarks earlier this week.
Thank you.
morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Katie Hendrickson, host of Note on KUAF at 11, Monday through Friday, but also tonight, the Sunday Symphony on KUAF at 7.
Yeah, and we have two works that are both planetary in different senses. The Fort Smith Symphony is opening their season next weekend, and they're going to be performing Gustav Holst's The Planets. So I'm going to play that tonight. You'll be able to hear that, and that's an interesting piece. It's actually named after the planets, but as I talked to John Jetter, and he says it's an astrological sense as opposed to the actual naming the planets from the astronomical way, if I can talk. So there's that. So it's like seven movements, which is kind of unusual for a symphonic work. It's a very it's one of those pieces that you hear it, and even if you don't recognize every little part of it, you're like, it's influenced movie soundtracks and like sci-fi films, all that kind of stuff. So it's very epic. It needs a lot of instrumentation, like brass and like weird instruments that like John Jetter's renting an instrument because they don't own it. I can't remember which one it was. It's a reed instrument. It's like one of the lower ones that just are very rare.
And I guess if you're a symphony and you don't have the instrument and you want to rent it, you're not going around the corner to find it.
I mean, where I should have asked when he talked to me about it where he rented this out from. But apparently, he says that only a handful of symphonies actually own this instrument, and so it's like something that whenever it's performed, that has to be rented. So.
Wow!
And then I paired it with Goreski's Symphony Number 2, which is his Copernican Symphony. But that would be the astronomy as opposed to the astrology aspects. But they're both 20. Last week we were talking about how you think of symphonies. You think of older symphonies. These are both 20th century symphonies. Holst, I think, wrote his in the 19-teens, and Goreski wrote this one in my notes say it's like 72 is when he wrote that.
That's
so it's
really
late.
New.
And
yeah.
Then I have about 30 minutes left to still program, so I'm going to be able to fit another work in there.
Now, if Holst's Planets was written in the teens in the last century, that means that the whole Pluto controversy doesn't even exist. Because this would have been before Pluto was called a planet or discovered.
And it is, like I said, it's seven planets, and Pluto's not on there.
Yeah, because it wasn't a planet. It's not a planet now.
It's seven, so it's like it's Mars, Venus, Mercury, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Okay.
All right. Tonight at 7, Sunday Symphonies with Katie Hendrickson.
Yeah, with a surprise 30 minutes at the end. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Spring isn't the only time for cleaning. As fall begins, many counties and cities are holding cleanup events not only in public arenas, but also allowing residents to clean up their homes. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis takes a closer look at what area municipalities and businesses are doing to clean up the environment in this morning's Week in Review.
Stories about our environment are ever prevalent, which makes sense as our environment is forever around us. Yesterday was the first day of Sebastian County's annual fall cleanup. Dumpsters were placed outside of City Hall in Central City and at the East Sebastian County Park in Lavaca. The cleanup event is coordinated by the Sebastian County Judge's Office and the Sebastian County Solid Waste District. Randy Hall is the director of the Waste District.
This time it runs from September the 22nd until October the 27th. It encompasses most of the cities in Sebastian County. It's to help residents get rid of old unwanted items like tires, appliances, or just general household trash.
Hall says that in addition to household waste, trailers for disposal of e-waste are placed at the drop-off points. He says that while most of the materials collected are household trash and go to a landfill, other items are dealt with differently after being collected.
The tires that are collected The Sebastian County Solid Waste District has a tire collection facility. We get those tires, and they go off to our processor for further processing. The electronics do the same thing. We have a processing center out at Chaffee Crossing. That's all collected and sorted, and it goes to our processor for further processing. They collect metal. Those are taken to a metal recycling facility in Fort Smith for further processing.
Cleanup events will continue to be held on Saturdays through October 27th. Although the cleanup events only happen twice a year in the spring and fall, Hall says that a new recycling program in the county has begun to take hold.
In February this year, Sebastian County embarked on a partnership with Ripple Glass and Davis Iron Metal to collect glass in Sebastian County. We initially started out with one drop-off point at Davis Iron and Metal. We had expanded it to include our recycle centers in Lavaca, Greenwood, and Mansfield.
Since the program began in February, Hall says that the Waste District has collected about 180 tons of glass for recycling. The Waste District's deal with Ripple Glass Company is similar to a deal that the company has with the Boston Mountain Solid Waste District in Washington and Madison counties. Ripple Glass gives back to the county a certain amount of Owens Corning insulation based upon the amount of glass sent in by the district. The insulation, made from recycled glass, is used by nonprofit organizations in the area such as Habitat for Humanity. Recycling was also a hot topic in Siloam Springs this week, as John Brown University announced that it was the first college in Arkansas to attain status as a zero landfill institution. That means that 100% of waste generated by the campus is diverted from the landfill. After meeting with city government and businesses in the city about a year ago, the college made a few alterations to its recycling programs. Steve Brinkle is the Director of Facilities, Services, and Sustainability at JBU. He says that the college expanded its list of recyclables that it would accept. When the campus started offering recycling about 20 years ago, only paper and cardboard were accepted. But now, they accept glass, metal, plastics, and e-waste, which are all recycled locally. The college also added more recycling drop-off points around the campus. But Brankle says that recyclables only make up part of JBU's waste. Non-recyclable material has to be dealt with as well.
We have two trash compactors. The big one that most of the campus trash goes to, we compact it. And then when that compactor's full, the city of Siloam Springs hauls it over to Tulsa, along with some other businesses in town that are zero landfill. It goes to a zero emissions energy plant, and they incinerate the trash, and they generate steam and electricity. And like I said, it's a zero emissions plant, so it's totally green. So nothing's going in a landfill. You know, you could argue that we're hauling it to Tulsa, but that's about 30 more miles than we used to haul it, but it's not filling a landfill.
Other waste at the campus is handled in a sustainable manner as well. Food waste is taken to an area hog farm, and used cooking oil from the campus's kitchens is refined to make biodiesel to be used by campus lawnmowers. Brankle says that going zero landfill is only one part of the college's sustainability plan.
We have a lot of other projects we're working on through our energy management, through our water usage, our sustainable buildings. Any renovation or new buildings, we make sure we put sustainable practice in place, you know, white roofs, low flow water fixtures. It's a multifaceted approach that we're doing right now. I mean, our next project, hopefully, we're going to be doing is working with the city of Siloam. The sewer plant is actually right next to our campus, and we're working with a deal where we would take the effluents, the clean water out of the plant, and use it for our irrigation on campus. So we don't use potable water. We would use gray water, basically. So it's a multifaceted approach to sustainability.
Aside from what goes into the ground or what is prevented from being put underground, environmental news can be about what goes above ground as well. Earlier this week in Fayetteville, the City Council approved a $48,000 contract to plant trees in the Mount Comfort Road area. The money to plant the trees came from the city's Tree Escrow Fund, which developers pay into when removing trees for a new development. Megan Dale is an urban forester with the city's Parks and Recreation Department.
The city has 7 years to spend the money to purchase trees and to plant either in that subdivision or development or within a 1 mile radius. So the funds that we collect this year will be spent within the next 7 years.
According to a city ordinance, trees planted using money from the tree escrow fund must be replaced within a mile of where the trees were taken down in the name of development. As per the ordinance, the trees to be planted under the contract approved Tuesday night are being planted within the vicinity of housing developments that were never completed in the Mount Comfort Road area.
In this instance, some of those subdivisions have been on hold due to the economy, and it's not appropriate to put the trees in there because new sidewalks or driveways would go in and possibly damage those trees, or there's no irrigation, there's just nothing out there.
And city foresters are likely to find out in the near future whether the tree escrow fund is helping to maintain the roof of the city's environment. Fayetteville is one of five cities in the state partnering with the Arkansas Forestry Commission in a study of the city's tree canopies.
There's recommended national averages, and we'll see where we come out at, what the statistics are of what our trees are doing, how much money they're saving us, and regarding stormwater and air pollution. It helps promote the benefits of trees, and it also gives us strategies to increase canopy. We're doing a comparison to 2002 to 2012 to see if our tree preservation ordinance has been working or if we're losing canopy compared to our 2002 numbers.
The study is expected to be complete by the end of the year. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Google Maps won't get you directly there. When you think you're lost, keep going. You're getting close. After going over a couple of one-lane bridges, you'll arrive at the brick house and metal building in the suburbs of Beaver, Arkansas. That's just north of Eureka Springs. As you pull up between the house and the building on this sunny morning, you'll be greeted by Baron, the aging yet friendly golden retriever. He's followed by Steve Gassaway, who's carrying a cup of hot coffee. And if you're lucky, he'll offer you one too. That metal building in most yards would store cars, equipment, tools, or toys. But Steve's storage shed is anything but. Oh, there's equipment inside. But it belongs to Steve's company, Mountain Bird Coffee. The machines are for roasting coffee, and the roaster has been warming up all morning. In honor of National Coffee Day next Saturday, September 29th, Steve agreed to show me how coffee gets from a seed to a cup. While we let the roaster warm up, he told me a bit about how the company started. He'd had a career in the construction business, and when the industry tanked in 2008, he had to figure out what to do next.
I had a hobby and a passion, which was roasting coffee and drinking gourmet coffees. And I had to re-educate myself. I was a 60-year-old man, no place else to go, educated, had a great successful business until that all happened. So I went to school. I went and learned more about just being a coffee roaster, but knowing a lot about the coffee industry. Oh my gosh, that is a great question, in as much as you don't just open a book and start into it, because the coffee business, the coffee world being almost, is relatively new in this world.
The Specialty Coffee Association of America sets the standards. Part of that is the Roasters Guild. He's a member of both. He's still working on his master roasting license through them, but he says he's always training, learning something new every day. The company started out small back in 2009, using an air popper to roast and selling at the Bentonville Farmers Market. Today, they use a 10-kilo or 22-pound capacity industrial roaster to roast the 4,000 pounds of coffee Steve estimates they sell each month to the 50 or so vendors all over the area. Vendors like Ozark Natural Foods, Little Bread Company, Harps, and Allen's. They envision more growth, building a warehouse, getting an even bigger roaster. Steve, with some help from his wife, Rhonda, tells me about how they came up with the name for the company. It started with showing a business plan to a trusted friend and coffee connoisseur.
When I showed it to him and talked to him, he looked at it and he stopped when he saw the name that I had proposed.
You won't tell me?
I'm not going to tell you, because it was a great name, by the way. But
I interject that Stephen had a dream about what he felt the logo would look like.
So anyway, I showed him this piece of paper, and then he saw the name, and he goes, he threw the piece of paper down on the floor. He looks at me and he says, "I'm going to tell you, you'll never make a good pimple on a roaster's rear end." And walked away from me. I was at his house, walked away from me. Wouldn't talk to me again.
Steve was devastated, almost to the point of tears. He went home that night feeling bad and went to bed.
I had this dream of being out in a forest amongst these mountains and seeing these beautiful birds. That's all I knew. I mean, there wasn't no place in a particular world, wasn't a particular bird, just these beautiful birds and the scenery. So the next morning, I called my friend up and I said, I apologize, didn't mean to hurt your feelings, yada, yada, yada. Here, I had this dream last night. He stops me. He goes, Mountain Bird Coffee. I went, what? He goes, Mountain Bird Coffee. That's the coffee name you should be using.
That friend came over that same afternoon with a piece of a paper sack. On that sack, he had the logo for Mountain Bird Coffee. Two mountain peaks with one bird soaring over, and it's been that way ever since. That same friend recently called Steve to tell him he had become one of the best coffee roasters. Well, we're almost ready to start roasting. One corner of the room holds large burlap sacks, each bag containing 130 to 150 pounds of green beans, depending on the country of origin. National Coffee Day is also a day to draw attention to the plight of the coffee farmer. Mountain Bird uses only Rainforest Alliance coffees that bear the Green Frog logo. That logo is a symbol of environmental, social, and economic sustainability. Farmers that are good stewards to the land, that pay a living wage, and grow under a canopy of trees.
What we have finally done is we've come back to where we deal directly with the farmers, because seed to cup to us means we want to know how it's produced. We want to know something about that farmer. We want to know about his family. We want to know about the farm hands that work there.
Steve and Rhonda are planning a trip to Costa Rica to visit La Manita Farms, where one of Steve's favorite beans is grown, and it's one we'll be roasting today. First, however, we start with a bean from Brazil. The roaster rests in the center of the room, a pipe going up through the ceiling releasing the smoke. Steve dumps green beans he has already weighed out into the hopper, a large funnel-shaped vessel on top of the roaster.
Okay. So the computer's connected to your roaster?
It is connected by roaster. And it really, all this is going to tell me is that I'm looking at what the bean temperature is, what this probe is.
Though everything is done manually, the computer is connected to a probe inside the roaster, allowing Steve to see that the beans are on track. See, each type of coffee has a profile, meaning it has to hit a certain temperature at a particular point during the process. It's really quite scientific.
And that's my profile.
It's like a line graph in blue on the screen. Once his profile for the Brazilian coffee is set, Steve pulls a lever on the machine, releasing the beans into the drum below.
Okay. Let's make this happen.
You can hear the beans turning as the drum spins. Steve moves back to his computer. The line on the screen immediately drops as the beans were room temperature, much cooler than the drum that has been set warming up all morning. As the line begins to curve upward, Steve carefully monitors the temperature dial on the roaster, controlling the gas burner.
The temperature here inside the drum is not hot enough yet. And I know where I want it to be. I know where the temperature that I want that to hit, which is the drop point that starts back up the curve. And this is one of those little secret things of, for my particular coffee, the way that I roast, of where I want it to be. So you can see we're making the turn.
In addition to watching the line, Steve also checks the color of the bean. There's a small round window on the front of the roaster, allowing him to see the color of the swooshing beans. He also pulls tears, a sort of scoop that will capture some of the beans, allowing him to pull them out and check them out. He's also listening. He knows that at a certain point, the sugars will begin to release from the bean, making a soft cracking sound. He has to be precise when releasing the beans from the roaster. When they reach the end temperature, something he has down to a science, he quickly pulls another lever, letting the beans fall from the roaster and into a tray that stirs the beans, allowing them to cool.
So here's the critical part of this coffee process that's happening right now. We want to be
I want to be in that area till the end. And I want it to be ending about that same time. So we're going to go through this whole profile. As you can see, this is only going to take about 13 and a half minutes for this one to process.
The beans are now a dark brown, the color coffee drinkers are accustomed to seeing. As the coffee cools, it continues to cook. Steve says that once the bean hits oxygen, it immediately starts disintegrating, releasing gases.
So once I get it and roast it, I have to immediately, within 2 hours, put it in a bag. And we used to naturally degas because they have to release, the molecular structure of a bean has to become one somewhat, and then it also releases carbon dioxide, and so it has to go somewhere.
See, I told you it was scientific. Now, Mountain Bird uses special paper bags. Have you ever wondered what that button is on the front of a bag of coffee? It's a one-way valve, releasing the gases without letting oxygen in. Using Rubbermaid containers to move the roasted beans from the cooling tray to the packaging area, Steve vacuums the beans into the machine. This machine weighs and then shoots the beans into the bags. He then places the bags on a conveyor belt, the top of each moving through a heated sealer. On a typical day, he is simultaneously roasting and packaging his beans. Beans ranging from Stevie's Espresso to the popular Morning Bird Blend. Getting the beans ready to be shipped to Missouri, Central Arkansas, even Memphis. These beans, however, are going home with me. For more information or how to find out where you can get your own Mountain Bird coffee, visit mountainbirdcoffee.com.
And chances are many of you right now are holding a cup of coffee.
Probably. Sunday morning.
Sunday morning. Perfect time for coffee. Mm-hmm. Do you like coffee?
I love coffee.
I like it a little too much. But coffee has a firm hold on our culture. We know that. And here is this week's kind of audio quiz about pop culture references to coffee.
I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup. I love Java sweet.
This is the coffee pot at work. Listen to it perk. Look at the coffee as it gets darker and stronger. Smell the honest coffee smell. Ah, smell it.
I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Every day, once a day, give yourself a present. 2 cups of good, hot, black coffee. Like this.
I've been driving hauling loads of grain all day long. Got about 300 miles to go. Well, I just dropped in to have a cup of coffee, friend. Yeah, just dropped in to have a cup of coffee, friend. Don't you offer me none of that whiskey. Don't need no wine. Gotta get that semi down line.
What do you say I buy you a cup of coffee?
Yeah, sure, let's go.
Follow me.
Garçon, coffee. This place.
Garçon means boy.
I'm feeling mighty lonesome. Haven't slept a wink. I walk the floor and watch the door, and in between I drink black coffee.
Good morning. Can I take your order?
Can I get a tall chai?
And a large black coffee.
A what?
Large black coffee.
Do you mean a venti?
No, I mean a large.
He means a venti, yeah, the biggest one you got.
Venti is large.
No, venti is 20.
Danny.
I'm hashing over an ethical dilemma, so I think I could use some black coffee.
What size would you like?
I've got a lot to ponder, so I think a large.
I'm afraid we don't have large, sir. We have piccolo, macho, mucho, and mucho macho.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
If you think you recognize some of those sound bites about coffee and would like to check your guesses, please go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
I think this week's was a little bit harder than the previous weeks. I also want to say, when doing some research for this, I was looking at a lot of 1950s and 60s commercials for coffee.
And that's funny.
Well, yeah, and there was one theme, because it was always either Mrs. Olson coming in, you know, you should try Folgers. And the premise was almost always the same, that the young wife would say, boy, I should make coffee for our guests. And the husband, your coffee? It's highly insulting.
Oh.
I'm glad coffee commercials aren't like the guy can't make coffee himself.
Right, right.
Anyway.
Folgers in your cup.
That's right. It's Sunday, September 23rd. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And I'm just going to say, Kyle, talk about Art Night Out.
Well, our night out is going to be an event at Crystal Bridges with the Old 78s, with some of the curators from with the Fayetteville Jazz Collective. We're going to play like it is a radio show from the 1930s.
Which means you'll be there.
Yes, because when you think of 1930s, you think of me. Is that what you're saying?
No, but when I think of radio,
yes.
And you said we'll be
yes,
doing this.
Yes, you're right. So. Yes, I'm sort of the host, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Will Rogers, who was the most famous American for an early part of the 20th century.
Now, here's the interesting. This is their fourth night out this year.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done, let's see, time travel, because the museum is laid out in chronological order.
Right.
They've done edible culture.
Mm-hmm.
They've done Journey into the Wild, which was the essence of the Hudson River School of Art and the grounds at Crystal Bridges. And this time, they're going to talk about the relationship between music and art in the 1930s when people think nothing good happened.
Right, depression and things like that.
Because we're talking about the Great Depression. But it was the time of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and the Federal Art Project that employed artists like Thomas Hart Benton and Stuart Davis and Marsden Hartley. So there's really a lot of interaction between art and the positive radio personalities.
Right, of which Will Rogers was one of them.
What was it that you said in the quote that you gave me, that he was John Stewart, Milton Berle, Mark Twain, and George Carlin all in one?
He was.
This is going to be a fun evening. It starts at 7 o'clock on Thursday at Crystal Bridges. Tickets are $40. You don't have to be a member.
Mm-mm.
You just have to go to crystalbridges.org.
Did we mention that there's dinner involved in this, too?
Oh, no, we didn't, but Case there is.
So for $40, you get dinner.
Yes, and Case has developed, and he'll be talking about, but he's developed this sort of American palate that it's going to be something else.
That goes with, again, with
yes,
the time period.
Yes, and he'll explain it, and it's eating and dining, and then the Fayetteville Jazz Collective. If the weather is nice, we're going to go outside and dance afterward. Should be a lot of fun.
So if anybody needs a date, Kyle knows how to get a hold of me.
That's right.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 23rd of September, 2012, anniversary of the first commencement ceremony at Harvard University. On this date, 370 years ago, 1642. Harvard had been around only 6 years, just two buildings along the edge of a cow pasture, nine graduates at that first commencement, which was conducted in Latin. There was a grand procession, a lot of parents in the audience, of course, and also curious onlookers, including many Indians. It was the first non-religious ceremony to take place in the English-speaking New World. Commencement lasted all day. In the morning, the graduates gave speeches in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, and in the afternoon, there were Latin debates on philosophical questions. And in between those, there was a great lunch, food laid out on the tables, a psalm was sung, and a cup of wine passed around the table for each man to sip. It's the birthday of the jazz saxophonist John Coltrane, born Hamlet, North Carolina, 1926. Grew up in a musical household, made his first recording in 1943 while he was serving in the Navy during World War II. During the 50s, he played with Dizzy Gillespie and Duke Ellington, but his addiction to heroin made him unreliable. And over, he was fired. He went to play for Miles Davis in 1955, who fired Coltrane 2 years later. Coltrane got clean, embarked on a solo career, and in 1965, he released his masterpiece, Love Supreme. John Coltrane, who said, "I start in the middle of a sentence and move both directions at once." And it's the birthday of the songwriter who wrote, "We made a promise, we swore we'd always remember. No retreat, believe me, no surrender." Bruce Springsteen, born Long Branch, New Jersey, 1949. Here's a poem for today by Bobby Bird, entitled Things You Can't Do in Albuquerque or Santa Fe, number 11. The metal blue sky, the sun with its 104 degrees raked across bleak Concordia Cemetery, those acres and acres of graves scattered like seed among the weeds and salt cedar, tombstones tumped to the side, a burrowing owl poking up from her cave in the dust, where the heart and soul of Rosa Gutierrez was laid to rest in 1916. That's where we found the grave of John Wesley Hardin, gunfighter, shot in the back of the head in downtown El Paso, 1895. John Wesley was 10 feet south of Rosa, and just across from the stone-walled entrance to the Chinese plot. Confucius waved at us and said hello, but he wouldn't say a kind word about this ancestor of ours, except that we're all better off that he's dead. Instead, Confucius pointed us to the L and J Cafe in an adobe across the street, where the ladies make fresh lemonade every morning, squeeze the lemons themselves. They serve it in big, tall, brown plastic glasses of cracked ice. The L and J is dark and cool inside. Their enchiladas con queso are delicious. Things You Can't Do in Albuquerque or Santa Fe, number 11, a poem by Bobby Bird from On the Transmigration of Souls in El Paso, published by Cinco Pontos Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world, you can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Joy Biles, engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUAF is supported by Ben Owens Shelter Insurance Agency, providing auto, home, and life insurance. 582-4990 for more information. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Cricket.
Where's Cricket?
Cricket is in extreme western Boone County near Omaha.
We're almost to the point of, it's not cricket season, right?
But it isn't cricket.
Yeah. All right. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Happy Sunday.